Thanks, George. Thank you so much for the intro and all your hard work. And hi, everyone. Really good to be with you on a Sunday. I'm honored to be here. It's really exciting. I've heard a lot about Sangha Live. It's so cool to be on the platform in this chair to see the donate button, just all the hard work that's gone in. So I want to thank George, Caroline, all the people that are organizing around Sangha Live. And when I first, I think it was a year ago, that Caroline approached me and asked if I'd be interested in doing this. And this is a little different than the sessions or talks that I'm used to giving. So I feel really excited to get to be here to offer you what I can in this very particular moment that we're in. And I want it to be a combination of practice, as George is saying, practice. I'll give a little talk. And then I really want to dialogue with you all to hear what's alive, what questions you're in, and what you think about this topic around the intersection of trauma and mindfulness and meditation. So before we practice, I just want to say just one quick thing in terms of framing. So my work the last 15 years, it's been around trauma. That's been the particular focus. I was trained as a clinician in Canada. And I'm down here in the U.S. right now. And the deeper I got into this work, the more that I found that the principles and practices around trauma-informed work had actually a ton of relevance for the general population. And, you know, in any moment when I'm in a room, there's a huge spectrum of trauma that's present. Research says about 3.5% of people will be experiencing PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. And then, say 80 to 90% of us will be exposed to trauma in different ways, but there's just always a whole spectrum there. Hey, George, I'm not sure if that's you. I'm hearing some sound. I don't know if that's on my end or if you could mute. Just want to mention that. So that's all to say that the work around trauma, wherever you would consider yourself on that spectrum, could be someone who works with trauma. It could be knowing people who've been impacted. You might be directly impacted or experiencing trauma. Wherever you're coming from, your experience is totally welcome here in this session. And really, this is fundamentally about nervous system regulation. How in this particular moment do we work with stress, adversity, and trauma? So I'm coming to you. I'm in San Francisco. I am currently traveling. I'm staying with a friend. I'm supposed to go back to Toronto to see my family, my niece who's 2. And then with this new variant that's come, there's just suddenly a lot of questions and stress. And I think the whole family is really, we're really exhausted. And we know, you know, if I ripple that out, I know that there's so many people and communities who are facing different struggles, whether it's traumatic loss or just the ongoing stress of the pandemic. It's just a really unique moment to be practicing. And I'm coming from a place where the practice is so useful and powerful in terms of trauma recovery. And there's particular things that's useful to know as we're heading in. So that's what I'm going to talk about when we get to the more talking portion. We'll talk about the kind of the pros and the cons. But for now, I'd like to practice with you all and just give you a moment to land. I appreciate there's something powerful about a Sunday to come together, not just from a Christian, old Christian ethic, but really from as a chance to perhaps pause, come together and practice. With your permission, I'd like to offer us 2 different practices over this next, say, 20, 25, 30 minutes. And instead of a 20 to 30 minute guided practice, I want to give you a sense of some of the different practices that I'm often doing with mindfulness teachers and practitioners. That's usually who I'm working with, is I'm training meditation or yoga teachers or coaches or therapists, you know, how to work with trauma in the context of contemplative practice. So I want to offer you a couple practices that will give you a sense of the trauma-informed work, but also give us a chance just to be in practice together and to land. So wherever you are, I invite you to find a posture that you'd like to be in for this next this next stretch. And settling in whatever way works for you here. You're welcome to be seated, or you're also welcome to be lying down. That would feel more supportive, or standing up if you need a little bit more energy. But just taking a moment to settle in here. You can have your eyes open or closed during this practice. And I invite you here to take a couple of deeper breaths as a way to begin. If the breath feels too activating or overwhelming, you can just ignore this instruction. Otherwise, just a deeper inhale, perhaps pausing at the top, and a slower exhale as well. And a couple of these deeper regulating breaths as a way to begin. These deeper breaths often support a quality of presence and also a degree of regulation in the body, the nervous system. I also invite you to notice any contact points with the ground. So that could be noticing sensations connected to the feet touching the floor, or the buttocks in the chair, or any other points of contact with the ground. Really, here is a way to support a sense of groundedness and presence. Also invite you to spend a moment here orienting to the current time and space. And by that I mean letting your senses orient to your surroundings. Just as a way in here into practice, that we're connecting to the present moment, not as a concept or idea, but as a felt visceral experience. So that could be noticing sounds in your environment, or making physical contact with something around you. Just noting, like, oh, this chair, this cushion. It could also be through sight, if your eyes are closed and you want to open them, and just let yourself track the room around you or your surroundings. Again, all is a way to help our nervous systems orient to the present moment. You could even reflect on the context of the moment that we're in. Maybe it's morning or evening. You could note where you are and the fact that you're making time for this session, this practice. Trauma will often take us into the past. And with a trauma-informed practice, we're just finding ways to keep arriving in the present. And then you're welcome to let that go. And you could close your eyes if you had them open, or you're welcome to have them open and downcast. But here, taking a moment to really settle into practice. And there's a lot of experience here in this community. So whatever way works for you, having a recognition of what's present here for you right now. That might be noting your emotional state or your mood right now? How are you coming to this session emotionally? And if a mood is clear, perhaps just noting that. Happy, sad, neutral. Any mood is welcome here. You might also notice what sensations are present right now. Where you feel certain temperatures, more heat, more coolness. Where there's pulsing or movement. Or perhaps the absence of sensation. Noting that as well. You might also notice the state of mind that's present right now. Maybe it's more active or distracted. Or more still and settled. And whatever you've found here, seeing if there can be some basic agreement with your experience. Just allowing all of those sensations or thoughts to simply be here. Not trying to push them away or pull them close. And I'm going to guide us now through three different anchors of attention. If you'd like to follow with me, you're very welcome to. If you'd prefer just to settle on a chosen anchor for you, say the breath or another anchor, you're welcome just to spend the next few minutes with that anchor, settling in. Otherwise, I'm going to guide you through a couple different anchors to give you a sense of a trauma-informed practice. We're really building in choice here. I invite you to begin here with sensations that are not overtly connected to the breath. Again, that might be the feet touching the ground, buttocks in the chair, or hands gently pressed together in the lap. But settling on a sensation or small group of sensations as a way to anchor your attention for a moment. A way to cultivate a sense of mental stability and mindfulness. And if at any point you find that you're distracted or lost in thought, just gently bring your attention back to this chosen anchor. Letting it be a place to strengthen a muscle of concentration, clear seeing. You could also notice your relationship to this anchor. Is it easier or more difficult to rest your attention here? just simply noting that. A gentle but steady focus. Every time we return back to the anchor, when we notice that we're lost in thought, we're strengthening that muscle of awareness, planting seeds for future moments of coming to a sense of awakeness. You're welcome to stay here, or I'm going to invite you to shift to a second anchor as a kind of experiment here. I will be working with an anchor of sound or hearing, if that's available to you. Bringing your attention to the soundscape as a way to ground your attention. Some people find sound to be the easiest place to rest attention, to cultivate mindfulness, letting sounds come and go in the soundscape. You might find yourself, it's useful and part of your practice, labeling sounds that you hear in your environment, or simply noting hearing, experience of receiving sound. Almost like you're placing your attention at the eardrum. And again, returning here whenever you find yourself distracted. Just a gentle, steady connection with the anchor. And once again, you can notice your relationship with this anchor. Is it easier? Is it more difficult to rest your attention here? Just noting that as part of the practice. And if you've been following my instruction, you can shift to a third anchor here, which is working with the breath. Often a very common anchor of attention. Could be the sensations of the breath coming in and out of the nostrils, or the rising and falling of the abdomen or the chest. A place to return your attention if you find yourself distracted. And also knowing that you are in practice in this moment, this quality of knowing what's happening as it's happening. Building that muscle as well. And again, noticing if it's easier or more difficult to work with this anchor. Does your attention slip off, or is it an easy landing place? And inside of that, seeing if you can just make room for whatever your practice is today. Whether the anchors are sticky or more subtle, we just keep showing up. And then for the final part of this practice, I invite you to notice which anchor you would choose to work with if we were going to continue a longer meditation. If you knew that you'd be practicing for another 15 or 20 minutes, which anchor would you work with? Maybe it's one of the three, or maybe it's something entirely different. And we'll end this practice by having you connect to an anchor of your choice. Turning your attention to whatever you'd like to be focused on for this last few moments of practice. Seeing if you can be with the anchor in a fresh way. Noticing what about this anchor supports your practice. And also feeling the quality of choicefulness that you're in here. That you're able to choose the anchor, the place of attention that fits you best today. And then in the next few breaths, I invite you to begin shifting out of this practice. So if you'd like to take a couple of deeper breaths or engage in a little bit of movement, you're welcome to do that. But just taking your time here, beginning to transition. And then whenever you're ready, you can bring your attention back here to all of us. Great. Thanks, everyone. I don't have my bell with me today, or I would ring a bell. Well, that went a little bit different than I thought. I was planning on doing a separate practice, but I'm going to weave that in as part of this talk. We'll see how this goes. I'll talk for a little bit. I'll say a couple things, but really, I want to know what's alive for you all here. We'll do one more practice that I think can give a sense of trauma-informed practice in a really embodied way. So that practice around working with a couple different anchors of attention really underpins a core principle inside of trauma-sensitive mindfulness. I'll define that in a moment. And that's really working with choice. So a lot of the people that I've worked with over the years, work with trauma for about 16 years now, and a lot of people who are experiencing trauma and great degrees of adversity are often experiencing a lack of choice, whether that's through the actual trauma that this person experienced. Maybe they experienced a form of interpersonal trauma and were left at a choice, didn't have any agency. Or maybe it's post-traumatic stress and someone's feeling like they're experiencing traumatic symptoms in a way where they don't have a feeling of choice in an ongoing way. So one of the ways that we can practice in a trauma-sensitive way is to be really giving choice back to people. Now, of course, we can go too far with this. When I started to do trauma-informed work, you know, partly as me and partly as a Canadian, and I didn't want to make anyone uncomfortable. And so I was taking it really far. I was taking it to an extreme. I was saying things like, you know, in the next few moments, you could open your eyes, or you could close your eyes, or you could do this, or you could do that, you know, whatever. And it wasn't helpful. It was too much. So there is this balance. And this is one thing I want to talk about here. There's a balance inside of this work around trauma of finding a kind of sweet spot or middle ground, kind of like a middle path. We have the story of Siddhartha on the River Ganges overhearing the sitar player and the student. And you probably all know this story where the student is saying, you know, how do I tune the instrument? How do I play it? And the teacher saying, it can't be too tight. It can't be too loose. You have to find this sweet spot. And that is really what we're up to here inside of trauma-informed practice. Said in a technical way, what is the middle path between exposure and avoidance? That is a real key principle and question inside of trauma-sensitive mindfulness. Mindfulness involves a degree of exposure. We want to actually build our capacity to be more and more present with life as it is. So, you know, there is a quality of exposure in this work to difficulty. If we're traumatized and we're practicing, in all likelihood, we will bump into trauma. And that's not a bad thing, whether it's traumatic memories, sensations, flashbacks. To come into contact with trauma in practice is often a very powerful thing. The issue here is that if we go too far into exposure, and I'll talk more about this, we can become overwhelmed. So some of you might have had this experience where maybe you're going through a really difficult time in life. You practice and it's almost too much. You're coming into contact with the intrusive thoughts or the memories or just the stirring around it, and practice becomes so difficult and you become overwhelmed. So there's a degree with exposure where we're wanting to open to traumatic stimuli, but not go too far in that direction. At the same time, we can also end up practicing avoidance. If people hear the work that I'm doing around trauma and they say, well, it's just about avoiding discomfort and difficulty, then we just end up practicing a quality of avoidance. We're just skipping around and not strengthening that capacity to be with, which is, I think, what so many of us are up to here. So let me, middle ground, finding our way. Let me just lay just a little bit of scaffolding around what I mean by trauma-sensitive practice, and then we'll do actually a practice around it. So as I said at the outset, trauma is in many ways ubiquitous. And there's a spectrum of trauma. It's hard to distinguish and say, well, you know, these teachings that I'm going to be offering are only for people experiencing post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's a whole spectrum of trauma. Trauma is fundamentally a form of stress. It's really the most intense form of stress that we can experience. We're all experiencing stress on some level. You know, George and I, we were meeting beforehand, trying to get organized before we came on here. Stress is present for us. It's also neither inherently good nor bad. Stress is happening all the time for us. We get good news that can be stressful. It's any demand for change of our minds and bodies. And then we have trauma. And trauma is fundamentally a threat to life and limb. This is a form of stress that's the most intense form of stress that we can experience as humans. Trauma technically involves any form of stress that involves a threat to our lives, or it may involve a threat to our physical integrity. So again, it's kind of a threat to life and limb. It's really where our survival responses come online. This is fight and flight. The technical definition is stress that involves actual or threatened death, serious injury, or threat to physical integrity. That's the definition in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So we all, most of us, will experience trauma on some level in our lifetimes. Because what research tells us, many of you will know this, is that we can be impacted by trauma, not just individually, but also by being around trauma. So we might learn that a trauma happened to someone close to us, or we witness a traumatic accident or event, or we might be people who are working with trauma closely. So we're exposed to trauma in different ways. It's not always just about being impacted directly. But just because we've lived through trauma, it doesn't automatically mean we're worse for wear. There's a whole body of literature and research talking about post-traumatic growth, that we are fundamentally anti-fragile systems and creatures who become stronger after facing adversity. So trauma happens. But then there'll be some people and communities who end up struggling with trauma in an ongoing way. And this is known as post-traumatic stress, where we have some cluster of symptoms that could be intrusive thoughts, memories, difficult physical sensations, flashbacks, or we dissociate from the body, we can't feel the body. There's this whole cluster of symptoms that fit into this category of post-traumatic stress, meaning that we've experienced a trauma and something is carrying on past the trauma. It's why I got so interested in trauma, is that trauma, it really challenges the idea that time can heal all wounds. You know, it can carry on indefinitely. And that's one of the most painful aspects of trauma. So we have stress, traumatic stress, post-traumatic stress, and then we have this diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. So again, we have this whole spectrum. So then, as you would have seen from the title, my work is around trauma-sensitive meditation or trauma-sensitive mindfulness. Basically, what I've been curious about and what we can talk about here is what's the relationship fundamentally between mindfulness and trauma? You know, put in conversation all the literature around the power of contemplative practice, what's happening neurobiologically, what's happening to us in a qualitative way, and then put that together with trauma. And the headline here, in case those of you don't know my work, the headline is that meditation can either help or hinder us, or help or hinder people who are struggling with trauma. It really depends on how it's practiced. And one of the, if that's of interest for all of you, if you're saying, okay, well, you know, I want to learn more about that, or maybe that's newer. I know many of you will have, you know, deep levels of competence here already around this topic. Then you could practice something known as trauma-sensitive or trauma-informed mindfulness. And trauma-sensitive basically means that you're being sensitive to the needs of someone struggling with trauma. That's the idea here. Or trauma-informed. You're informed about the risks and rewards of meditation when it comes to trauma. So that's what I mean by trauma sensitive. And I'm going to do a practice with you all here. But fundamentally, what I'd say, you know, people ask, well, what is this work about? It's really about learning how the nervous system responds to stress and adversity and trauma, and then being able to tailor our practices towards that inside of meditation. That's really what we're up to here. And in my experience, when I'm teaching teachers, it's really, especially if they're newer to trauma, it's helping them understand the deeply intelligent nature of our survival responses that are related to trauma. We all have different strategies that we, factory loaded strategies that we will adopt in the face of trauma. So I've seen it this year. I imagine you all have your own experiences and stories of people and families and communities adopting very different strategies to cope with the adversity that we're facing around the pandemic. For some of us, we might kind of fight against it. Others of us, we might check out and dissociate. We all have these different strategies. Maybe we go solo. Maybe we want to be with people. And fundamentally, trauma-sensitive mindfulness is about having deep understanding, compassion, and respect for the different strategies that we work with, that we will have in response to trauma. It's not about coddling people. It's not about not practicing. It's actually about giving people the tools they need to be able to work with high degrees of stress inside of contemplative practice. That's really what we're up to. So I have a story for you about that, but I actually want to do a practice with you first, and then I'll tell this story. Just try to ground it in actual lived experience. So we're going to do a practice here that involves working with hands. If you don't have access to your hands, you can use your feet, or you can visualize this practice. And this is a practice to try to convey here what I mean by trauma sensitivity and what trauma sensitivity feels like. And I'm hoping that this will be applicable to you inside of your meditation practice, but also any work that you're doing where trauma sensitivity might be useful for you. And there's going to be two parts to this practice, and they're kind of contrasting elements, as you'll see. So let's just take a moment here and settle in together for a moment as we begin practice. So just dropping your attention inward for a moment. Noticing what's here, what's present. Questions that you're in or anything that's been stirred here so far. Just seeing if you can connect with kind of a baseline right now. Like what's your mood? What's your energy level? What's the state of affairs internally? And then I'll guide you through this practice together. You can either listen to me with your eyes closed, or if you have access to sight, you can open them and I'll show you the practice here. So again, we'll be working with our hands, and I'm going to have my hands up here on the screen so you can see them, but you can have them in your lap. You don't need to have them holding up. So for this practice, invitation is to, with one hand, go ahead and make a fist, closed fist. And I'd like you to imagine that the job of this fist is to stay closed. And in staying closed, this fist is taking care of your safety and your survival. Okay, so closed fist, taking care of your safety and survival. Then as an experiment, with the other hand, go ahead and try to open the fist. And really get to experience that for yourself. So trying to pry open the fist, fist is staying closed to take care of your safety. What happens? What happens to your breath? What happens to your fist? What's the experience like for you? Just noticing that. Okay, and then you can let that go. You can shake it out if you want. Okay, second round, same thing. Closed fist, taking care of your safety. And then go ahead and bring a quality of care, respect, and curiosity into the other hand. Really fill the hand in an imaginary way with those qualities, compassion, curiosity, respect. Then when you're ready, go ahead and place your hand underneath the fist. And as you're doing so, see if you can communicate something like, good job. Of course you're closed. That's a deeply intelligent response. You're taking care of safety. And it's like you're saying, I have no agenda for you to open here. I'm here, I'm present, I'm listening. And again, you're just noticing here what happens as an experiment. What happens to the mind and body? What happens to the fist? And you could even notice if there would be a particular word or phrase that the fist would want to hear that would feel supportive. Yeah, so it could be something like, I'm here. I've got you. I see what you're taking care of. There's nothing you need to do. Whatever it is for you here. You can experiment with the quality of contact here, but just bringing a level of support. And then when you're ready, you can begin to let that go. And then just invite you to pause here before we shift, just to check back in. Noticing if there were similarities or differences between the two parts of the practice. And just noticing your state as we begin to move towards shifting. Okay, thanks everyone. You are welcome. I am not tracking the chat right now just so I can stay connected to you all here. But if you'd like to share, I know this is a community. Many of you know each other. You're welcome to share in the chat, how that was for you, especially if that would be a helpful way to process. If emotions came, that's also welcome. Happy to talk more about that in our Q&A, which will happen here in a minute. But just, whatever came up for you, it's welcome. Why I'm offering that practice is I could, you know, talk about trauma sensitivity for a long time. And yet there's something about just feeling the quality of bringing care, respect, and curiosity to deep, factory-loaded, hardwired responses that live in our psychobiology. When we're in the domain of trauma, we're working with older parts of the brain, as you likely know. So we're working with, there's a model that's been a little debunked called the triune brain theory, but really talks about prefrontal cortex, limbic system, and the reptilian brain. But, you know, just as an idea here, the systems that we're working with that correspond to trauma are in the oldest parts of the brain, the brainstem, the limbic system, the amygdala. And so when we're working with trauma, even if we are trying to shift it or trying to open the body, it will open with a yes. It doesn't open with a no or trying to change things. You know, I've been in meditation halls where someone was saying, you know, I know that I'm safe. I know it, but my body is giving me signals that I'm unsafe. How do I work with that? So there needs to be a huge quality of respect for these responses and these strategies that will often be kind of playing out in our lives. So I'm going to give you a quick story about how I've seen this happen and kind of a quality of trauma sensitivity that's not, it's about respect, but it's not about coddling. Right? I mentioned that earlier. This isn't to go so far as to say, well, if someone's feeling distress or discomfort in practice, they should immediately move away from it. That's not what I'm saying here at all. If it's traumatic, they just might need some particular tools in order to work with it well, and often a quality of support from other people to help them work with it. So pre-COVID, I was at a practice group in Berkeley. It was probably, I don't know, maybe 20, 23 people that were there. Teacher who I really respect, who'd done a little bit of training with me around trauma-sensitive practice. And so we were there, and it was a really sweet kind of weeknight group and practice. And there was a newer student who had come. And after we did a longer meditation, the teacher said, I just want to open it up and hear how the practice was for people and questions, things like that. And the person who was a newer student raised their hand and said, I hated that practice. I wanted to run from this house. I wanted to get out of here. I found your voice grating. It was really, they're being very honest. And, you know, you could hear the oxygen kind of left the room. And I was particularly curious to watch the teacher, like, well, how are they going to handle this? And are they going to personalize it? And what I saw, which was so cool, was the teacher kind of took a breath, settled in her chair, and they said basically something like, that's awesome. That's such great noticing. And the room kind of relaxed a little bit, like got curious, and then asked this question and said, do you know how far away you want to run? And then that was a moment where the whole group got really curious. It didn't go into a cognitive explanation as to why that happened or even trying to fix the problem, so to speak. It was got really curious. And the student said, oh yeah, I know where I wanted to go. It was that hill outside of this house. We were in, there's a hill outside. I wanted to get up. I wanted to go up there. And so the teacher took a moment and said, well, do you want to go there now? We have the space, we have the time for it. I just, would you take a buddy? Will you bring someone with you? And the person said, okay. So they left. We still had some chunk of the group left, and the people left the room. They went with a friend, and they came back probably like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes later. And I'll never forget this. They came in the room, and the person who, the newer student, had this look on their face of aliveness. They were really flushed, but just, there was like not happiness, but a quality of just like something good had happened. So we all got curious at what happened. And the student sat down and said, I just want to thank you for trusting me that I knew what I needed. That was really profound for me. And what I did is I went outside and I actually ran wind sprints up and down the hill. Went up and down the hill a couple times. And now I actually feel like I'm ready to sit in a different way. And you know, it was beautiful. There was a nice discussion that happened after that. But that feels like a fundamental principle or orientation in my world around trauma sensitivity. Now, whether that person was experiencing trauma or not, we could have that conversation. But there was an allyship and a movement that really relates to this practice that we just did, trusting that the body knows on some level, trusting movements, trusting impulses, not to coddle, and also still having a container. Now, I respect that there might have been other times where there wouldn't have been the space to actually run outside, or it might not have been safe. So we have to pick and choose as we go. But that's the general orientation here, is giving us a framework or a map of how to work with trauma and adversity inside of a meditation practice. And what it means in my experience is bringing in different tools from inside of trauma therapy and trauma work as a supplement, not as a substitute, but very much as a supplement to our meditation practice. So, said a couple of things now, and in a moment, would love to open it up here for our dialogue. I'll just give you a couple more data points, and then let's open it up. I'd love to hear what's on your mind about this, or what would be useful for the group. I've gotten to work with a lot of great Buddhist teachers inside of my work around trauma and mindfulness. Sitting Buddhist retreats has been a really important part of my life. And it was coming out of a retreat where I ended up highly dissociated. I was at the Forest Refuge. I don't know. Some of you might know it, in Barre, Massachusetts. I was doing a longer term retreat. I'd been sitting for about 6 weeks and was highly dissociated, meaning I was really disconnected from my body, my lived experience. And the instruction I was getting was just to keep coming back to the cushion, and something wasn't working. I was really kind of worse for wear coming out of practice. That opened this whole dialogue about 18 years ago now. And so that led me to trauma work and just led me to write this book. But the thing that feels most important is keeping meditation at the center of any discussion here. So I got to have a conversation with some of you might know Tara Brach, pretty well-known Buddhist teacher in the Insight tradition, Theravada tradition. And I asked Tara, how do you, she was a clinician, she worked with trauma. And I said, how do you think about this? Because sometimes once we start getting into the conversation around trauma, we just start throwing nervous system regulation practices at people in an unhelpful way. And we get away from the practice, which is to actually keep coming back to the present over and over, whatever's there. And Tara's point, which was a good one that I want to relate to you, is she said, I always keep mindfulness and meditation at the center. And it's basically, I have people practice until they can't. And then if they can't, if they're overwhelmed, then I'll bring in some self-regulation practices. So for example, and we can talk more about this if you'd like, in the courses I teach, we have a whole spectrum of 8 different practices. Here's how you'd work with body scans and interoceptive awareness around trauma. Here's what's known as a resourcing practice, where you're purposely directing attention towards objects or anchors that bring you a sense of well-being. Maybe we're working with self-compassion in a really powerful way. Maybe we're doing work around social context and belonging. There's all these different tools that we can bring in that people have developed over time around trauma work. But my point here is that meditation remains at the center. It's not like we're just doing trauma therapy. That the whole point is to keep coming back to practice until someone ends up feeling overwhelmed or they feel like they can't practice anymore. And in that case, we might need some additional practices like we just did, working with other anchors. Maybe we're doing this practice for 10 minutes before we're heading into meditation. There's a whole series of practices. We could do more here if you like. A whole series of practices that are meant to enable us to access the benefits of practice. It's not meant to be a substitute to practice. So I said a couple things. And we're at the top of the hour here. So I'm going to pause and see if there are questions. I'm going to open the chat. This is a newer platform for me. So I'm going to have George tag team this with me. Hopefully my internet connection is here and I haven't just been talking to myself the whole time. George, if you're here, maybe I'll invite you to help me with the, can I click on the questions here? So you can either, come on. You're welcome. We could have some dialogue here. I'm always happy to do that. Oh, okay. I see a little. I'm good. Okay. Good. I'm happy. I love dialogue. It's great because then I can hear what you're interested in and whether questions got answered. Or if there are questions here, I'm happy to try to answer them as well. So George, how should we roll here?
Well, David, I'm barging in. Sorry. You can start by the ask a questions box if you want. You have four questions already. If you click on the ask a question box.
Oh, there we go. Oh, yep.
And there are some upvoted ones already. And then I'll just, as I have the voice on, I'll just invite people if you want to come on screen.
Great.
And then just let me a note on the chat box and I'll invite you.
Got you. Thank you. I see now. Is it possible to bring on the people who asked, George? Like, can I bring James on if he wants to come?
If he's willing to.
Yes, you're totally in choice here. Anyone who asks, I just.
And I'm having Susan trying to come on screen. So if you want to be with her right now, I can just bring Susan already.
And then you can
the written questions.
Okay. And then I'll come back to the questions. Yeah, sure. But I love this question, James, that you're asking about unanchored meditation. So we'll come to that for sure. Why don't I start? I'm just, while we're waiting for Susan, I see there's 8 votes for, John, this one got really upvoted. Let me jump in with this. And then if people can come on, please, George, bring them on. So let me start with John. I'm wondering how relevant the concept of trauma is to threats to sense of self. So not a literal threat to life and limb, but a threat to who we believe we are, what we identify ourselves to be, like I'm a mother, father, or I'm a man, woman, or I'm strong, weak. Oh boy. I'm sorry. This format, I lost you. I see someone's come on. This box is blocking you out. Okay, there we go. Well, Susan, I see you here. So why don't we, I'll come back to John's question. But yeah, hi, welcome.
Okay. I don't see you, but that's great. thank you so much for taking my question. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I have a query about if I'm facilitating a group and somebody has a traumatic response, flashback, sensation, thought, whatever, in the midst of the group,
mm-hmm.
What are some skillful means that you might suggest of handling that, both for the individual and the group?
Great. And is that happening in a dialogue? Do you have any particular situation? Like, is the whole group aware that this has happened for someone, or is it more something that's happening for someone kind of more privately in their practice?
This is hypothetical, but so I'm saying they're in a group and everybody knows.
Okay, got it. Great. Yeah, these are the scenarios that I'm working with a lot. So first point is to not worry. And one of the things I feel like, because of the charge and intensity around trauma, there can be a feeling like, something wrong or something bad has happened. And the first quality of embodiment, Susan, that I'd say is to, as much as you can, access this feeling of this isn't bad news. This might actually be good news for this person. Given that here we are, we're practicing something very powerful. It's not surprising. We can assume that people are going to bump into their trauma as we go. So that's the first thing that I'm trying to communicate, both with my embodiment and my words, is nothing bad is happening and we don't need to try to make something different happen. So however you would do that, and we can all figure, you know, for me, it's like I take a breath and I feel my butt. I try to just relax. And then I'm trying to assess with the person what's going to be most useful in the moment. So if they moved through it in their practice, great. That's normal. That happens. Like actually that could be very powerful for them. If they're finding themselves somehow destabilized inside of practice or in the conversation, then I might try to work with them live inside the group. So we might do a grounding practice, like, can you feel your feet? Can you still notice that I'm here with you? Can you, you know, if you know the student, just seeing if you can find something that they could hook onto. If that doesn't support them, also just having some interpersonal interaction, that's also very often very regulating, as you might know, for humans. So, you know, I'll see if we can have a little back and forth there. And then third, if that's not working, then what I'd suggest is either taking a break with the group and having a one-to-one conversation with the person. Or if it feels like they're in a place where they can wait till the end of the session, just saying, let's check in. But the thing I'm not doing, last thing I'll say is I'm never trying to sweep it under the rug, which I used to do where I'm like, uh-oh, something bad's happening. What I'll say is, yes, this is powerful practice. People are dealing with a lot right now and I'm here to support you. So I'm trying to, the whole group knows it. So I'm trying to convey to everyone, it's good. We got you. I want to make sure you have tools and then we'll move from there. Those are a couple of my thoughts. What would you add, Susan?
That all tracks with, I think, how I would handle it. My concern is if somebody's like spinning out beyond what, like in that case, I agree with you. I think that you might need to take a break so that you can really focus on the person that's so dysregulated.
Right.
And work one-on-one for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I would want to work with the group when we reconvened a little bit too, to kind of normalize.
Absolutely. Everybody. Absolutely. Yeah. You're like, just like you're saying, I think you're assessing the degree of the dysregulation and whatever intervention is going to support the person in the group in that moment. That sounds right to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Okay. Why don't we come back to...
So David, yeah, excuse me, George. But we have a lot of people wanting to come on screen. And the question you were addressing first, John, is willing to come on screen and ask the question. So
great, we'll just
try to bring him on. Okay.
Thanks, George. Then, thanks for all your
work. We have
a
lot of other people. I'll try to bring people on and then you can see the other questions.
If it's okay.
Okay. So I'm inviting John.
Thanks everyone for your patience. This is a new platform for me, so I'm excited to learn it. Thanks, George, for all your work. Okay, I think John will be coming on. Let's see what happens. Hey, hi. We did it. Hi, John.
Hi, David. Great to meet you.
I'm reading
your book at the moment, actually.
Cool.
So my question was, I suppose, about how wide we can draw the kind of concept of trauma mm-hmm. and use these tools to help people. So, you know, in opening, you spoke about, well, you know, trauma is basically a threat to life or limb, which many people experience, many people in ordinary lives, you know, experience at some point. But also many people do experience very strong threats to their sense of self. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be through, you know, I mean, it could be as something as dramatic as, gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a family, a separation, which affects your role as a mother or a father. Or it could be something like, just trying to change a deeply ingrained and damaging habit mm-hmm. that makes you feel safe. So I suppose it's about safety.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are all sorts of things that can make us feel unsafe apart from threats to life and limb. I just wondered mm-hmm. what observations you might have on that.
That's great. Let's debate it. Because I hear you, and this is a conversation that I'm in often about where do we draw the line. I would say that threats to identity would not necessarily fall into the category of trauma, though they could create significant nervous system dysregulation. So for example, I see people going through massive amounts of change, what you're naming, maybe it's as a parent, or there's a divorce, or someone has a job and they lose their job, and it creates a massive sense of identity, which could create, I'm not diminishing it at all, legitimate fight flight responses. You know, when we're having that level of threat to senses of self, it could create a response. And where I've been struggling the last couple of years, just to be transparent, is that the term trauma, as you probably know, is just, it's becoming, there's a wider and wider scope around it. And, you know, we could go so far as to say, oh, that traffic jam was really traumatic, or, you know, and so I've been in conversation with my teachers that I learned from about trauma used to be just acute trauma, you know, the one-off traumas. And then it's been building, and I've been reading this article about concept creep in the humanities, where we start to talk about trauma, it becomes ubiquitous in a way that waters down the term, and it doesn't have the same significance. And that's what I'm concerned about. So I'll hit the ball back to you here, but my take would be, I wouldn't consider that traumatic, and it can create significant nervous system dysregulation where we're feeling a sense of threat that is basically could be on par with traumatic symptoms. I just wouldn't necessarily put it into that category. And people might push back on me on that, and I'm open to it, but what would you say around that?
Yeah, I'm quite new to this. Mm-hmm. I've had a kind of bit of confusion, really, like you said, about I suppose it's around how useful the word is, and in some senses, and the context that one works in. But to me, it seems like there might be a difference between what you would call trauma, what you would label as trauma, mm-hmm. on the one hand, and the range of situations where the practices themselves might be helpful. It seems to me that a lot of the practices you recommend are going to be helpful to people who don't technically suffer from trauma.
Right.
But as you said, are undergoing some kind of threat to their safety that triggers all sorts of nervous system responses.
Yes.
So kind of pragmatic, I suppose. I like to be pragmatic.
Yeah. Well, the most, I appreciate that. The most pragmatic aspect of this work, I mean, you're reading the book, is that most people at the end of a training will say, this seems relevant for the general population who's facing all sorts of degrees of stress and adversity, which I think is true. What's important about trauma is that people can get caught in a loop with post-traumatic stress where there's significant degrees of activation that came from this traumatic event that locks people into a cycle that they really might need some very specific guidance and support to untangle from. So again, the practices we did here, useful for everyone. And then there's a degree of trauma where someone actually might need different tools and one-to-one support. We didn't get into it today. My work is mostly discerning at what point do you tell someone it's time for you to go. I'd suggest you work with someone in a one-to-one way. And that's, I mean, we can get into that here if people want, but so that's why I think it's useful to keep, there's some boundary still around traumatic stress as a concept.
Yeah, that's great. Really helpful. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for the question. It's a great one.
So, David, I'll keep on. I have a couple of people more coming on screen.
Great.
And then I would like you to, if it's okay with you, because there's a couple of questions that have been upvoted. And one of the participants, James, can't be on screen because he has no access to his camera. So I'll just bring another couple of people, and then you can please address the questions.
Great.
The written questions.
I'm going to answer this one with James, and then please bring the person on. So James asked the question, what do you think about unanchored meditation? And two, what is the relation between breath work and trauma? Let me answer that, and then please, whoever's coming on. So yes, there's research around this. As I've understood it, between the difference between focused attention and open awareness. So unanchored meditation, meaning that you're just sort of allowing whatever, you're not directing your attention particularly in a particular way. The best research around this, as I've seen it, suggests that open awareness can be more challenging for people struggling with trauma. The reason why is that we will have a reflexive orientation to traumatic stimuli. So when we're working with focused attention on a particular anchor, it's easier to regulate attention. If we move towards open monitoring and we kind of pull back our attention, then we're more likely to reflexively be pulled into relationship with traumatic stimuli. That could be, and that could be end up being overwhelming and unhelpful. So that's the first part. And now the question's gone. Where did it go? Part two, oh, answered. Part two about breath work. Oh boy, this is a big one. Breath work will tend to activate, will land us in what's known as hyper or hypoarousal, these dysregulated states, which can be, they can be very evocative for people who struggle with trauma. I've done breath work. I have issues around breath work because I think unless you're doing it with a particular frame around trauma, you can end up creating more dysregulation and even re-traumatization. So if you're going to be doing breath work, I just encourage you to work with someone who has some awareness around trauma because it can be helpful, but it can also be really intense and too much for people who are struggling with traumatic symptoms. So thanks for that question, James. And hi, Victoria. You're here.
Hi.
Thanks for being patient.
I was just trying to figure out where, because sometimes there's a time lag. So
yeah,
I thought,
yeah.
Am I ahead or behind? Thank you so much. I appreciate your work so much because think it's an enormously neglected field, and I think so critical because the very people who I think need mindfulness practice the most are often the ones who have experienced trauma. So it's
agreed.
Well, anyway, that's, I know that you know that, or you wouldn't have dedicated your work to it, but I just want to thank you.
Thanks.
So meaningful. I am concerned. It's a little bit like the question from Susan. I think it was Susan about a group practice. And I have been attending groups almost constantly since the beginning of the pandemic and in a wide range, some more strictly in a tradition like Tibetan Buddhist, like, for example, with Lobsang Chenpa or Alan Wallace and people like that. And then some that are more, like Sangha Live, this is a wonderful platform, which is more open, you know, people come from a variety of traditions. Mm. And what I've seen pervasively for the last, year and a half or more has been that there are people who express themselves, like in the chat or whatever, who are really suffering, and they're seeking something, some kind of, affirmation or a real sense of Sangha, a real sense of community. So I am, I have this dream of trying to create a container for people who are seeking a kind of Sangha where it's, where they're safe, where it's not, it's hard for me to articulate really. It's still also in my formative, I'm thinking about something, but I feel really drawn to it. And I've been working really hard, on a variety of, I'm trying to train myself and learn a lot and read, which is how I discovered you. But my concern is, how to maintain a safe and warm and welcoming group situation, especially because this would be an online platform. So of course that has pitfalls, inherently. But somehow without, like the practice we did with the hands, which is so powerful. I'm just wondering to what degree, if there's a sense of people who are particularly vulnerable in a group situation, but it's online. So you're not actually, you don't have the benefit of like face-to-face contact and all of these other things or body language. How much to try to rely on somatic practices and to sort of keep the general, you know, as much as possible, keep the whole community safe and as much as possible regulated during this time of like holding this container?
Yeah, just that. Yeah, no problem. I mean, that's it. I mean, thanks for, I'm glad you're drawn to that. One question for you is, would you be doing this solo or would you imagine having multiple facilitators or what would be your, what's the structure?
Well, I this is of course probably not the appropriate time to, I just applied for your mentorship program. I'm sure I'm sure it's insanely competitive, but, my dream would be to invite experts like yourself or, you know, people who are willing to, share their expertise and, but have a different format, not in the stricter sense of like the Dharma teacher and the Sangha, but a little bit more, so it feels more welcoming, a little safer for people who are especially vulnerable or who aren't, it's kind of like a stealth or Trojan horse kind of thing that, for people to be drawn, not to draw people, but to be available to people who are maybe intimidated by like going to a mindfulness retreat or a mindfulness day long practice.
For sure. That's great. So, I mean, so many thoughts, but try to synthesize. I think that's, needed and valiant, that you would, try to be creating. Let me back up. I hear stories a lot right now of people holding groups where there's a number of people who come on either through the chat and people are saying, people are A, really hurting, B, need some good contact, and C, how can I hold this in a safe way? So I think that aspiration of what you're saying is huge and it takes some work. And one of the tensions that I hear people in is, how do I offer the space so that people can come, be exposed to the teachings, be in some learning and challenge. And at the same time, how do I keep people safe along the way? And I think there's just a tension point inside of that. You have a Zoom group. I don't know how many people are here. I can't see. Anytime we're over 10 people, it just starts to get very difficult to hold well, especially if you're solo. So a couple practical suggestions. Having a second facilitator, like in this case with George, George and I touched base beforehand. We're trying to tag team this. Having a second person that we're working with together, very helpful. Setting up the ground rules, as you probably know through my work, it's like all the front end work that we can do to have people know, sometimes we call them off ramps, like where are the places that they might need to take a break or back off of practice. Setting up a good container on the front end is really useful. And then the third thing and final thing would be, how are you monitoring? So what are the ways that you can monitor people? For example, on Zoom, sometimes we'll do a one word mood check to hear how people are doing. If someone says I'm suicidal, for example, or they're in a bad way, do I have the means of getting in touch with them? The question I'd have for you and for others is, how much effort do you want to put in to creating these safety nets? Because you might end up on a lot of calls, one-to-one work after a group. And so it becomes this tricky thing of what's enough so that you're getting the work out there. And then what are the safety things that you want to have in place? So I'd say go for it with that aspiration. And I think it's needed. I really think it's needed right now. But we can't, safety can become a tyranny if we're working too, has to be safe. We have to try our best. And we know that people are going to end up in, they are in tricky spots and we have to decide what we can take on in terms of responsibility. So I think it's a balance that we have to figure out as we go. We could talk, you and I could talk for hours about this, I'm sure. Maybe we will, but
I applied for your, but it just, I just see it as such a burning need. And the reason I came on today was because as I'm trying to formulate this anyway, just in my thoughts, just to sort of run it past you, but I appreciate the validation. I know how challenging it is. I mean, for me, it's a mission. Yeah. So, I'm prepared to be eaten alive if that's what it takes. Because I just need compassion. But anyway, I won't take any more time.
Victoria.
But thank you so much. I really appreciate your input.
Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, David, I'll bring the last person on screen.
Please.
Maybe you could just address Itamar's question because she's been really upvoted. If you I can just bring Erin, and then she will wait a little. Is it okay with you?
Yes, please. Yep. So Itamar, can you please talk a bit about mental disorders with regards to meditation? For example, meditation in mental hospitals for with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, personality disorder, psychosis, etc. Couple thoughts. One is, it's a great question. Two, this isn't necessarily my wheelhouse. I've been focused specifically on trauma. The place that I would look, I don't know if I can chat this in here, is to, I hope that got, I don't know if that got into the chat. Oh, it did. So looking to Cheetah House. This is Willoughby Britton at Brown University on the East Coast of the US. Willoughby is doing a lot around bipolar disorder, depersonalization disorder at the intersection of meditation. There's some fantastic references on that website, both articles and also practitioners who have volunteered to work with anyone who's experiencing meditation-related difficulties. My wheelhouse is around dysregulation. So if schizophrenia is creating nervous system dysregulation, some of these practices will be useful, but there will be places where someone would need some extra support around a mental health disorder. And I would recommend Cheetah House would be a great place to look. So that's my 30 second, but there's of course like hours to say about it. So, and because of time, Erin, I see you here. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm also reading your book. We're on the mindfulness teacher training with Tara and Jack.
Oh, cool.
And I think, I don't want to take up too much time because I know that somebody else got, like, way more votes in their question than they're coming on, hopefully. But basically, I just have struggled with meditation ever since I became a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if that's an experience you relate to. And I didn't want to say, I actually wrote initially that I kind of get this sense of feeling traumatized towards meditation as a whole, mm-hmm. but I don't want to use the word traumatized because I'm not really sure whether it would apply. It's more just this intense, unsafe feeling every time I come to the practice. And yet on the parallel to that, every time I've run a meditation for the people that I've run it for, you know, they all seem to feel safe in that space, but I feel very unsafe, even mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to if that's a common experience and if, you know, how you then approach like making sure people feel held when you don't even know how you resource yourself, because I've found less and less ways to resource myself the more I teach.
Thanks for saying that. And I'm sure you're not alone. I know you're not alone, actually. I think it's really, really common. And I've met a number of teachers, and I'll include myself here, where I'm like, how can I be offering practices when I'm feeling my own challenging relationship to the practices? And I'm nervous that people are going to feel my lack of confidence in the practice itself for my life. And so you're absolutely not alone. And I had my own, I'd have to ask you more questions and we don't have time for it here. But when I hear you say unsafety, I had my own rupture with meditation, which was confusing because I was starting to teach it and was getting really into the practice. And it really rocked me where I was like, how, almost like I was a balloon and then I had the rupture and it was just the air was all going out and I didn't know what to do. I'll say it's taken me 10 years to really come back into a open-hearted relationship with practice. And I needed to just go away for a little while and really focus on different practices that had to incorporate more interpersonal interaction and movement. And I needed to generate safety. Like I was feeling unsafe and needed separate practices outside of meditation to then carry those into practice. So it was good for me to go away for a little bit and I had to come back to it kind of in my own time. So we could connect more. Mostly just want you to know you're not alone. And this is it's a challenging path that you're naming. I have a lot of empathy for it. And I'm sure you're doing great work in your teaching. So
thank you so much, David.
Yeah. Yeah. Please reach out. You can just reach out to me and we could say more if you like, try to find. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, George, we've been left with a minute.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions more. One upvoted. I don't know if you want to take it or.
Is that okay? Can we go a minute over?
Please.
Okay, let me look here. Hold on, pull up. Is this the one about how do I handle that one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Last one and then we'll close. So Donna asked, how do I handle that in some ways I actually trigger trauma for someone else? My daughter-in-law lost her mother recently and my mom or mother energy triggers her greatly. I empathize with her immensely. However, this has caused me tremendous stress because there's nothing I can do to alleviate this energy. Oof. This is a hard question because it deserves a lot of time and space, but I appreciate it got upvoted. Two things. One, Donna, I have a huge amount of empathy for what you're naming here. That's really hard. That sucks. When you're triggering that level of trauma for someone else. The place I'd look is, I don't know if I can squeeze this in tight. In my work, we look at this thing called the window of tolerance, which basically means what's going to support a person or a system, be it a family system, to be able to tolerate their experience. Are there practices and resources, given the situation as is, that are going to actually support the window of your daughter-in-law? So that might be honest conversation. It might be taking space for a while, but if you check out, on my website, there's a talk on the window of tolerance. If you check it out, you can think of it in a systems way. What's going to support or detract from the window of tolerance for her and the family, and just make decisions against that. And I'm sorry I can't say more because of time, but it's a really important one. So thank you for that question. And that's really hard. George? Why don't I close here? And then I'll pass it to George. Everyone, thank you. Thank you so much for spending a part of your Sunday. I feel like this topic is massive. And the moment that you get into it, it's just like, well, what about this and that? And so I hope that there was something here of value for all of you. I'm honored to be here. It felt like a really good use of time. I've heard a lot of great things about this Sangha. So thank you. As George mentioned, and I said I would mention it too, this is a Donna-based organization. Big props to anyone doing Donna-based work. It's hard. So if you're moved to support the work, if you took some value in this, would please contribute a little bit of Donna. A little bit goes a long way. It's shared between Sangha Live and us. For my work, I'll be using that to do work with people who are doing scholarship programs with me. So it'll go to a good cause. Your generosity will go a long way. And just a deep bow. Thanks for all your work. George, it's awesome to work with you. We went 2 minutes over, but thank you, and hope to be back with you all one day.